The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
From beautiful Merrick, Long Island, New York, this is WGBB Sports Talk New York, 95.9 FM, 1240 AM, on your dial. I'm your host, Mike Wadone, joined as always by the man we call Cappy, Chris Caputo. 516-623-1240 is our number. Again, that's 516-623-1240. Cap, welcome back. Good to see you.
All right. It's lots of fun. Glad we're back in the studio. We're getting closer to that March Madness time.
Absolutely. It's all basketball all the time. We'll talk a little bit about that. Talk a little high school. My ending came quick for my team, but it was a good year, and we'll get to all that, some different things. But we are really, really pleased right now to be joined by a four-time NCAA championship official, 10 Final Fours, 28 NCAA tournament appearances, and he was the 2005 Naismith College Official of the Year. His nickname is TV Teddy. This is Ted Valentine. Ted, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me. Very elated to be here.
Well, it's really great stuff. You know, as Chris mentioned, this is a very exciting time of year for basketball for us as coaches. We coach together, you know, and having someone with your experience on and your resume, really, we couldn't find anybody better, and we thank you again.
Well, hey, like I said, I'm honored.
Well, much appreciated. First thing, you know, just to kind of start off, you know, obviously, you ref for many years. I believe you started coaching, reffing Division I in 1981. And this past year, you decided to hang up the whistle. And despite the fact you did almost 80 games, I believe, last year, what was the kind of impetus behind finally saying, you know what, I've had enough?
Well, hey, times change. I'm one of the most veteran guys. I didn't work three quarters of my life on the basketball court. I'm now 67 years old. I didn't work three quarters of my life. And there's other things that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Like I wanted to, you know, podcast, a book, I work in a Parks and Rec. There's other things that I was missing out because I believe that you don't own anything. And I've been to the promised land. And the thing I got to thinking about is most officials, when they get older, you start hearing people say, you should retire. Mm-hmm. You should retire. But I never got that. I mean, I look like I'm 60. I'm 67 years old, and I look like I'm about 50-something. And yeah. I decided, hey, I wasn't going to work no more Final Fours. I'm still going to work the games. And I just felt that it was just time. A lot of people don't think, a lot of referees have ended their career either knees or knee replacements, mm-hmm. hip replacements, and I'm very healthy, so, you know, by the grace of God, and I just made a conscious choice.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because I wanted to address this a little later, but bringing that you brought it up, what was your fitness regimen in order to get ready for a season? And you know, can you tell us what you do mid season when you're on the road? You're in Wichita, yeah. Kansas. You know, what are you doing? You know, diet wise and exercise wise to keep yourself in such great shape?
Well, what people don't understand, as I've got older from age 31. You have a natural metabolism, and as I'm getting older, I kind of noticed some things, and then I started 2 weeks training right after the season. I gave myself 2 weeks, and I started. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I wasn't going to let it go, and everything that I've done has been like high intensity. Like, I joined classes with a lot of younger people. Like, we're doing box jumps, so we're lifting weights, we're pushing sleds, we're on rigs, we're riding bikes in a sauna, and I was just all this stuff. I would always condition my body. We'd run the treadmill, yeah. We would do rowers, and I was in class with younger people, and that would maybe, and they more or less inspired me to do, you know, to get in the best possible shape. Just being with them, being with the young people, like 25, 30. And I'm the oldest person that was in the class,
sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was just like, I felt that I needed to do a year round And when I went on the road, I had a weightlifting regiment.
Okay.
And it would be like I'd fly to the city, you know, get up early, 3 o'clock in the morning. I fly to the city. I'd have breakfast because you know how airlines are now because you don't not guarantee that you're going to get there.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
And I'd stay in the Marriott hotels and they have gyms or Planet Fitness and I'd eat, go to sleep, go lift weights about 2 o'clock. I always had a workout like arms one day, back one day, chest one day, arms one day, but mm-hmm. I never did any legs when I was reffing. Okay. Never did any legs at all.
Yeah.
And I did that continuously all the time. And so I was always ready.
Ted, this is Chris here. Let's stick with that for a little bit. You know, some of these referees in maybe a 5 month period are reffing over 100 games in many different cities. What's the hardest part about the travel and the amount of games that you guys are doing during that time period?
Well, I was one of those guys when I was younger. I was in my 30s and 40s. I noticed as I've gotten older, I didn't want that. See, the good thing for me was that they would send me into a city, and I would work 2 or 3 games out of that city. See, that made it easy. That made it less taxing on me. Okay,
right.
I didn't have to get up. But with the day and age that you see people going cross country, this and that, and I've always said as I've got older, when it got to the month of February, if I was doing all that travel, I'd be more tired. I would be. I'd be tired if I had to fly to a school or fly to a city and drive 2 hours. If you know anything about the SEC conference, you're flying into a city and you're driving.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're in the Big 12, you're flying to a city and you're driving. So, and I was in the ACC many years and I live in ACC land and it was easy for me to navigate around because there was like 6 or 7 schools I could drive to, you know, and that made it easier. But the hard part is, when you're flying to Kansas State, and you're driving 2 hours, and then you might have weather. It just gets very taxing. And I know that people probably think that, well, we want to have those veteran guys. But thing is how sharp are we?
Mm-hmm.
How sharp are we? I mean, in the month of February, especially because I call it the dog days, coaches really are tired of seeing this. They're really tired. I don't care what anybody says. I don't care what kind of rapport you got.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of good friends that's coaching, and I don't care. The wins and losses add up, and you're in the dog days of February, and they don't want to see you, and you don't want to see them.
Yeah, you had, in doing some research, and you know, mentioned that you said that February is by far the toughest month to officiate.
Yes, by far. And the reason why February is difficult is because if you're in the middle, you're trying to play for a conference seed, you're playing for the, if you got an upper echelon team, you're playing for a seeding in the NCAA tournament. So you may have lost 3 games in a row, and I know this, that you lost 3 in a row, and I come to your place, you're going to be a little bit on edge. I don't care. I don't care.
No,
you
got to
know about this business. I mean, you're going to be, you're going to be a little snappy. Maybe the kids aren't performing the way that you want them to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The kids are irritated. So now you're in this dog days of February, and everybody doesn't settle down until we get till, you know, like this week. Everybody will settle down a little bit.
Okay.
Everybody will settle down. And because they're playing the last game, like on Saturday. But if you notice in the month of February, there's a lot of altercations that take place.
Yep.
A lot of altercations. Yes.
We're talking with TV Teddy Valentine, who is a former NCAA referee. You got your big break in 86 where they moved you up to the Big Ten. Can you talk about what the difference was at that point where now all of a sudden you're on the big stage every night? Was there any difference for you, you know, as far as reffing in that situation versus maybe in some of the smaller Division I games?
Well, hey, I tell you what, I got definitely, I end up with a PhD real quick. Because, see, the people don't understand, I came in 1986, and I was 31 years old. I was 30-something years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell this story. My dad came to watch me work the Fab Five. I watched Michigan change basketball overnight.
Mm.
I would be in Illinois one night, and we were short shorts. They were short shorts. And you go to Michigan the next night, they had the long baggy pants and black shoes and black socks. So I saw basketball change overnight.
Yeah.
So I knew we were heading to something else. My dad, and may he rest in peace, came to watch me ref Ohio State and Michigan. The Fab Five and Jimmy Jackson was playing for Ohio State, and Gary Wims was the coach. And my dad was always notorious of being late. It was the first time my dad ever watched me, you know, reffing.
Okay.
So I took him across the street, and I said to my dad, big old guy, I was always intimidated about my dad. He was just big, and I was his only son. And he was a Marine. And I asked my dad, I said, Dad, can I ask you a question? Yes. He goes, well, go right ahead, son. I answer, go ahead. And I said, Dad, how did I do? My dad said, do you really want to know? Okay.
Ouch.
Okay. And I looked at him, yes, sir. He said, you got that baby face, and they will tear you up, is what my dad said to me. So my dad got in the car, drove on home. I lived in Worthington, and I cried all the way home. I cried because I wanted my dad's approval. That's what every son always wants, his dad's approval.
Of course.
Approval.
Oh, yes.
So years later, John Thompson was coaching Lonzo Mourning. And I was in California, and it was just the next season. And I was trying to do something according to the rules of NCAA, and John Thompson starts yelling and screaming and using profanity on me, which I know this is a PG station. But he started using profanity on me, and I was scared and I was shaking. And he said, who told you that? And I said, NCAA. He said, blank NCAA. He said, you'll be a great referee when you get a mind of your damn own. And right then and there, years later, my dad and John Thompson were very influential about what they said to you.
Yes.
What they said to me, because it's not about the intent of the message, it's about the content of it, you know, that people were passing on to you. And I got in the Big Ten in 86, and then I'll tell you this, they hired six officials. They hired six of us. At the end of 1 year, they fired five.
Wow.
I'm the only original referee left.
That speaks volumes.
Only the original one. And I was in the Big Ten with Bob Knight, Gene Cady. Judd Heathcote. Tom Izzo was the assistant coach.
Yeah.
Clem Hoskins, Gary Williams, Lou Henson, Tom Davis. I was in here with some stellar people. I'm with some stellar coaches. And if you didn't know what you were doing, they would tear you out the frame. They would.
Ted, I want to take you back just a little bit. So you right now you're in Charleston, South Carolina. You grew up in West Virginia, went to John Marshall High School. You were a baseball player and then went on to Glenville State. So baseball was really more your sport at that time. Can you tell us how you got into the basketball side of officiating?
Well, we got time. People don't know I was a coach first. I used to write Bob Knight.
Really?
A letter. Yes, he was on a show called The Fishing Hole.
Yes, yes.
There was an old show years ago, Fishing Hole, and I lived in Ohio, West Virginia, and that was a coal mine area, and we'd go fishing in these strip pits, and I wanted to learn how to fish, and Bob Knight be on Saturdays, and I'd write him a note, and he'd send me back a note.
Really?
Okay, and this was, he sent me back one. This was before I got in the Big Ten, okay, and he sent me back a note. So, years later, I wanted to say something to him about that, but I never did. But as far as me getting started, I was coaching a junior high girls team, and the coach took maternity leave. And I was doing my student teaching in Western West Virginia,
Okay.
And the lady was named Karen Pickens, lived in Western West Virginia. I went to Glenville State College at the time. And I was coaching the team, and I started picking on refs. I wanted to be a coach. So I had a school assembly. I figured the crowd was in my favor, so I figured, hey, you know, I try to intimidate refs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I intimidated one of them. I said something to them when they're back and forth. And I said, hey, get her out of the lane. They had a big girl, Buck Cannon, a big girl. The girl about 6'1", 6'2". So get her out of the lane. She's hogging the lane. Every coach says that when you got a big man that's really dominating. Get him out the lane. Get him out the lane. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Every coach says that, man. And so Russ tells me, says, Mr. Brown says, coach, that's enough. Now, one of them was my math teacher. He taught him the same school I was. And one of them worked with good friends with the principal.
Okay.
So I figured, hey, man, I got it made.
You got him in your pocket.
About the second time I said something, he said, coach, that's enough. Next time, whack, hit into the technical foul. Technical foul. Got a technical foul. We're in front of our students. And our principal was tough. He didn't allow no booing, no hissing.
Mm-hmm.
Our principal's tough guy. So I left him alone. I go to another guy. So I start picking on him. He said, coach, that's enough. Coach, it's this, net. Finally, I wouldn't get off of him. Whack. I got two technical fouls. This is the first half.
Oh,
I got two technical fouls. Okay? So finally, I'm going, man, they ain't got no guts. They can't give me the third one. They can't. There's no way. There's no way they'll give me third. Because most referees aren't going to chuck you. Most of them aren't.
Yeah.
You know? So now, before half, I say something to the older guy. And he turned around. Whack. Hits him with a technical foul. So now, halftime, I'm gone.
Yeah.
I'm gone. Okay? So I go past my principal. He takes me in this room. He says, Mr. Valentine, you've embarrassed my school, and you just coached your last game.
Wow.
One game, gone. Okay?
Half a game.
Now, here's the irony. The next year, I was on work study, and I was a baseball player, and I was a janitor in the gym.
Mm-hmm.
At college, I was a janitor, and I put all the towels away, washed. There was two Afro-American referees. They were refereeing. They were having a good time, and I said, well, how do you become one of those dudes, okay? And so they told me how and this and that. So I started refereeing, and I started out with a pair of blue jeans, a pair of Chuck Taylor tennis shoes. They were about $15 then. Now they're about $60 now, $70 now. And I had a black and white pink shirt because I didn't know how to wash laundry. Okay. So I had a shoestring lanyard and one of those metal P whistles. Okay.
Old school.
Okay? So that's how I started it for $8 a game.
There you go.
So Mr. Messenger was the guy that taught me the lesson. He brings the team and they're playing Gilmer County High School. So I decide if he says something, I'm going to tee him up. So I'm reffing. He's not moving. He's not saying anything. Finally, I walked over to him. I said, Mr. Messenger, do you remember me, sir? He says, yes, I do. And he says, you were probably gunning for me tonight because you're young. He said, what I did to you, I show you there's some discipline in this. Mm-hmm. And you're finding it out as a basketball referee. Mm-hmm. He said, you're going to be a good ref, and I was teaching you a lesson.
Wow.
And you need to teach coaches the lesson along your journey. And I picked it up from him. Okay?
Yeah.
And the rest was history. I always worked for $8 a game, and the rest was just history. I mean, it was just everything took off. Bob Montgomery out of Mountain West Virginia, he was my baseball coach. I played for him. I went back and coached with him, and it was just I couldn't get enough of this basketball. I couldn't get enough. I couldn't get enough. I couldn't get enough. I couldn't get enough. And I purchased a VCR tape. A VCR back then cost $1,300.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what it cost. I get the VH tapes for them games and I play it again. Play it again. And I play everything over with and visualize everything and the rest is history.
So Brian Kersey, who was the ACC supervisor of officials, he said of you, he commanded respect, never faltered or swayed. He could talk to anybody and people listened to him. And I think there's not much of a better endorsement than anybody could give to a basketball official. And you mentioned Coach Bob Knight, and I don't want to stay on it too long, but there's two questions I'd like to ask you about Coach Knight. Number one, in general, was he the most difficult coach that you had to deal with?
I would say, at first, the first time I was with him, I was in awe. I was at awe of how big Vicky was.
Yeah.
And the officials used to get real nervous. And when Coach Knight would yell at you, all 22,000 in Sumney Hall would get quiet. Sumney Hall would get quiet.
Yeah.
And I started like picking that up. You know, every time he yelled at a player or yelled at the referee, the place got quiet. It got quiet. You could only hear him. Everyone to hear what he had to say.
Yeah, and that's a big place.
Yes, and he was a very intimidating tower figure. But over the years, I had enough of his games, and I started to understand him a little better. I started understanding because my dad always told me, you need to have better awareness of what's going on around you.
Okay.
You know? And I started getting awareness, and when he would roll his sleeves up, he'd roll his red sleeves up, he gonna go to work on somebody.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he'd do. He'd pull his sweater down, he was quite content. Anytime he was in a close game, he never bothered the referees.
Okay.
Never bothered the referees. It's when the game got big is when he started bothering referees.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he was. I mean, he was a great coach. He was a tiring figure. Very, very tiring figure. He was he intimidated a lot of people. See, a lot of people don't know, I was an Indiana fan when I was a kid.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Quinn Buckner.
Scott May.
Scott May.
Kent Benson.
Which
ended
his son. Yeah. Yes, sir. I was an Indiana fan.
Okay.
As a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my other question is, and you know, when... As a basketball fan growing up and coach, and this was all over, and this is something I'm sure you've been asked a million times, but I want to get it right directly from you. So it's Indiana and Illinois. Coach Knight, you eject them from the game. Luke Recker goes in. Illinois grabs the rim. It should have been perhaps a goaltending call. So Coach Knight is on his way out to check. And I'm using air quotes to check on Luke Recker, and you give him his tee to get him out of the game. Now, everything I've read, it said that you did not eject him for walking onto the court because he was allowed to do that.
Right.
I'm assuming he said the magic words.
Well, a lot of people got to understand the mistake in Indiana. When you go to Indiana, they had a great big chain. All the chairs were chained down because don't forget, the year before I got in the league in 85, he took the chair and threw across the court.
Yes, exactly.
Okay? I saw that game on TV. I was a kid. I mean, that was the year before I came in.
Oh, yeah.
So we have this funny play. We got two rules that have changed from this game. Two rules has changed.
Okay.
Number one, I was the lead, and Rucker went in, and the McLean kid, I'll never forget Plains Day, I was the lead.
Mm-hmm.
See, there was no rule in place. See, now there's a rule that the spring load got to be back in place by the time the ball gets there.
Okay.
Okay? There was no rule for that.
Ah.
Okay? There was no rule. No rule from it at all. There was that came in a brand new rule.
Okay.
The rules changed the very next year. Okay? So, he argued and argued and argued and argued, and I was trying to get distance away from the Rucker kid that was laying in the paint.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to get to my right. Well, I'm not very smart, but I know what a hypotenuse of a triangle is. You go from A to B, not A to C. Okay?
Yes.
Okay? And he come down and gave me a bunch of stuff. And so that was his second technical foul. Well, we didn't have no rule about how many technicals.
Okay.
Well, when he walked back down to the seat, the first time he walked around me, on the far end.
Yes.
Well, when he went to leave this time, he wanted to get another party shot, so I gave him another technical. Like, bam, here's another one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's another one, okay? And that was the third. And really, we didn't have a rule then. And one of the refs said, well, Ted, we're going to shoot two down here. And the ball, I said, no, we're going to shoot four down here.
Oh, boy.
We're going to shoot four. And the people were throwing money in Indiana. They were throwing money on the court. They were throwing money. And how I knew... I just had this gladiator in me, still being a young kid. I start picking the money up off the floor. I start picking it up. Like, and people were booing and all kinds of stuff. There's nickels, dimes, there was quarters. There was all kinds of Canadian coins. And I had a handful of change, and I walked to the table. And I think the referees I was refereeing with, they were a little petrified.
One of them was Eddie Hightower, right?
Yes. And I put the money down on the table, and I started to say something to the guy, and I said I'm going to say something funny. I said, please tell the fans to reject the film. The inning's obviously going to court. If you're going to throw money, throw more in the penny. And I said, no, sir, no, you can't. So you knew right then and there, I made the table laugh when I said that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ted, you were known to be kind of down the middle, that you weren't necessarily going to give the home team the call. A lot of visiting coaches would actually be happy when they saw your face because they knew that you weren't going to be intimidated by the crowd. You actually would enjoy having a lot of those fans around, and you said, you know, you miss some of those fans now. And what was it about kind of staying neutral and being, you know, kind of the good guy for the visiting team?
Well, I was taught by Jimmy Burr. He was probably the best ever to put his shirt on.
Yep.
Jimmy Burr was a great referee. He was one of my mentors. He was my mentor. Timmy Higgins was my mentor.
Yeah.
And I watched these guys work on TV. And I was very fortunate to work 7 Big East finals with them. I was very fortunate as a kid, you know. And Jimmy Burr one night said, do you want to become a great referee? We'd been working at Ohio State. And he remembered every call that I made. And there were some calls that were in between that I could have given the visiting team. And it was, you know, if you know anything about refereeing, there's some great calls out there. There's some great.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? And he said, you're being too precise. You're being too precise against a visitor. And that's what he taught me. And he taught me, and I live with that ever since. Because I was always, you know, I learned that you can have 40,000 fans, but what about that team that's only got 20 or got 10?
Yeah.
You know, because everything's just with the homers anyway. That's what everybody used to think. They think that the referees would, you know, would get on the same plane, get on the same car, you know, with the team. And that wasn't how I was taught that way. I mean, I was taught by Burr and Higgins how to referee the game, you know, how to keep the game balanced. I was taught, keep the game balanced. If you can keep it balanced, nobody ever says anything. They don't. You know, it's when you look up and you see the game is unbalanced. You know, and what I mean by unbalanced is that I've learned growing younger is that, you know, I've heard coaches say, oh, you're going to give them every call. If you would take a basketball game with what's going on now, if you're the visiting team and you go on the road and you chart the calls, and you're not getting those calls, and you go back to your place and play, you end up getting those calls. Yeah. See, and I just always found the middle. I just always kept the scales of justice balanced. And it's just one of those. It's just one of those things. It's one of those knacks, because I just know how to keep the game balanced. I just have a memory. I see stuff. I mean, and I knew that when you hear a coach, they say, just be fair to everybody. Just be fair. Be fair. Just be fair. Every coach wants that. Every coach wants it, but some coach wants it. Hey, I'll take all the calls.
Sure. Yeah.
Give them all to me. Okay? I'll take them all.
Ted.
But eventually, he's going to go on the road, and they're going to be all against him.
Ted, did the criticism that some people give you were very demonstrative. You had a lot of big games, and you know, I think when people go and look back at some of your calls, you actually blew the whistle probably less than some other referees. But did the criticism get to you? Is that maybe one of the reasons why you decided to give it up?
No. A lot of people don't understand. I have more fun the last 10 years than I've ever had. I haven't called a technical foul on a coach for the last 10 years.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Because I had him when they played.
Mm-hmm.
I had him when they coached. I had Steve Alford when he played. I had Steve Alford's son. And it was just that I learned from the NBA way, because I was in their system for about a year, and I learned how to referee. And I've done the same thing over the years. And I know that when I was young, I had all this energy and all this stuff, and I had, you know, demonstrative calls, and it was showtime. And as you got older, say what? That is tiring. You know,
sure.
You're tired. You're tired, you know, once you go through that stuff. And so I learned to, okay, just be nice and easy. Be like the good grandpa. and I just adapted. I just changed, and I call less plays, less fouls, because I know how to hold the whistle. Mm-hmm. I know how to let them play through stuff. I just know how to do stuff. Don't ask me how I do that. I don't have a clue.
That's a gift.
On how I do it, but I see the play start, develop. Oh, okay, finish. Don't call no foul.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand it.
Yeah.
So, Ted, I got to ask you a favor before we let you go. I've been coaching basketball, and this is a personal favor. I've been coaching basketball for the better part. I'm 57 years old, for over 30 years. I coached on the Division II level as a head coach, assistant coach. I'm coaching basketball forever. It's been my passion. And I try and I try and I try to get better with the officials each year, and I think I'm doing it as I get older. And I'm a little demonstrative on the sidelines.
Right.
My one pet peeve with officials is, you know, not yelling, not using profanity, whatever else, asking a question as an official, you know, either on a dead ball or kind of as a play's ending, and I'm being ignored. What can I do? What can I say to an official to let them know that I would appreciate it if they would listen to me?
Well, number one, most officials don't know how to talk. They really don't.
Okay. Can I get that? This is on tape. Good.
But, no, seriously.
No, yeah.
If you ever want to play a game with an official, try to engage in a conversation and see what he says.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He don't know how to talk to you. He don't know how to talk normal to you. See, me, I always know how to talk,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And they don't know how to talk. And that's the way where I was when I was younger. Oh, you're very intense. I want to get this play right. No, coach. No, coach, you're wrong. No, coach, this. No, coach, you're wrong. You don't ever tell a coach that he's wrong. Mm-hmm. You don't ever tell a coach he's wrong. Ever. Because that, to me, the first thing is, nobody likes to be told that they're wrong.
Right.
Okay? And just this next generation just doesn't know how to talk.
Yeah.
You know, they just don't know how to. See, like, when I grew up, and once I've been around the track, I had to learn to talk. The supervisor told me, you got to learn to talk to people. You got to be more approachable to people, you know, and you have to be a certain way. And some people were almost intimidated of me, and I would get the mystique off me. I would engage in a conversation with them.
Sure.
I would engage in conversation because I don't want them having this mystique. And I've had most people say, you know what? You're a good guy. You know,
yeah.
But sometimes I have to be the one to step outside of my zone.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about life right here. Let's talk about this situation. Let's talk about, okay? And you just, some officials don't know how to talk.
Yeah.
Every official should have a communication course. Because mm-hmm. I have a master's in speech communications. And if they would ever learn how to communicate interpersonal or personal communication, they would understand the coach, but they're too busy trying to get across their point.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
yeah.
Ted, in 43 years, do you have any hysterical stories that either happened before the game, after the game, or even during the game? You know, either with a player or with a coach that you could share with us.
Yes, I can tell you one. I was at Wisconsin. This was years ago, and it snowed so bad, and I've been on the road by 3 weeks. I was on the road for 3 weeks. And I went out to clean the snow off at O'Hare Airport, off the rental car, and I was going down to Illinois. It's a two-hour, 20-minute drive. So I drive all the way down to Illinois. I've been on the road 3 days, and I put these bags in the car. And as I got to the store, but to buy something, and I went to the trunk of my car, I said, where's my referee bag?
Oh, boy.
I said, I was frantic, where's my referee bag? So I called the Marriott. They said, you left your bag outside. They said, we got your bag. Now it's 2 hours. Now, I'm thinking about getting back in the car and driving, and then I'm not thinking, you're kind of frantic. And so I'm trying to, you know, go down there as fast as I can. And so I realized I can't make it, so I called one of the officials, and John Beilein is coaching Michigan, yeah.
Michigan
at the time. John Beeline was my high school 10th grade teacher. A lot of people don't know that.
Really?
And yeah, John Beeline. Wow. Yeah, he was. And they're playing Illinois, and I can't remember, was it Underwood or whoever it was is the coach of Illinois, okay?
Yeah.
And I can't say, you know who it was.
Yeah.
And I go, so I go to the locker room, I got no clothes. I got no referee clothes. So other official named Bo Borowski, big stocky guy.
Yep.
I lost all this weight, and I said, Bo, I don't have no pants. So Bo said, you can have these pants. I said, Bo, I don't have no shoes. He says, I wear the same size shoe that you wear. So he said, I got a brand new pair of shoes. Okay? So he gave me a shirt, a pants, and Kelly Pfeiffer gave me an undershirt. Okay? So I tried to talk Bo into a new pair of shoes, but he hadn't put on them damn shocks, and they were bad for you, okay?
Yeah.
So I put them on, and these pants were like three sizes too big.
Uh-oh.
Three sizes too big. So the trainer came in. I'll never forget that. I can't even think of the trainer. He came in. He says, I got some tape. So he got this black tape, and he wrapped it around my so then he wrapped it around my waist. It looked like a cummerbund, okay? So all these clothes, the shirt, I lost all this weight. The shirt and everything was big. Pants was big. And I go out. John Beeline knows about it. As soon as I go shake his hand, he's looking at me. He goes, were you trying to star like Tom Hanks in a movie Big? Okay. His clothes are baggy, hanging off of me. Everybody's getting a laugh. I mean, these clothes are two times the size of me, okay? And they're just, and I'm just pulling them up and holding it up, and the fans are laughing. Valentine, where's your clothes? Where's your clothes? Okay. And it was just like, but that was probably one of the funniest times that I've ever had, really.
That's fantastic. Well, the podcast is the TV Teddy podcast. Again, 2005 Naismith College Official of the Year. Incredible resume. Ted, it's been amazing having you on. Thank you so much. Hopefully we can do it again. I know you're writing a book. Maybe when that comes out, we'd love to have you back on. But you gave us a great, great education tonight. You helped me a lot. I appreciate it. And it's just been a pleasure having you.
Hey. Thank you very much for having me. I'm very elated, and anytime you need something, please feel free to give me a call.
Absolutely. Thank you again so much, and enjoy this March Madness from your TV this time.
I sure will.
Okay.
I appreciate it very much. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Ted Valentine.
All right.
Tremendous official, and just as you can see, a great resource for coaches, officials, and anyone with basketball. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back on GBB Long Island Sports.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your Gust Buster today.
You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Talk New York here on WGBB 95.9 FM, 1240 AM. Our number is 516-623-1240. Again, that's 516-623-1240. If you'd like to give us a call, talk a little Ted Valentine or college basketball or anything related to sports, especially here in New York, although we're gonna change gears here a little bit, Cap, and talk about some USA hockey, both women and men, gold medal in Milan, and just for all the hoopla and worry about the rink and everything else, really just a great tournament for both teams and very exciting hockey.
Yeah, that was great hockey, and especially for the United States to be able to come up with a gold for the men, first time in 46 years to get a gold medal and have some of those guys on hand, you know, the Mike Ruzionis, and, you know, talk about a goaltending situation like, you know, we had with Jim Craig back in 1980. You have a goaltender standing on his head, 41 saves, and bringing the team to the gold medal. A little tough to see a Devil score the game-winning goal, but, you know, Hughes scoring the game winner was really a lot of fun. And we could talk a little bit more about that, too.
Yeah. Something that disappointed me a little bit, though, is hockey players are really known as kind of the most down-to-earth and really good guys, and I'm sure they are. But the kind of complaining and sour grapes from Canada after the game about the format, three on three, which I get it, is not, I don't believe that's the way you should decide a gold medal or any game, quite honestly, but 3-on-3 is tough. So they were a little complaint about that, but also, you know, they were saying in the press, if you watch the game, you saw who the real best team was, and, you know, basically blaming the whole thing on the fact that, just as you mentioned, the USA goalie stood on his head. I found that really a little disappointing, because I think, obviously, had Canada won the game, you wouldn't have never heard anything like that.
Yeah, I agree. The good part about this time around is in 1980, it actually was not a, you know, medal-by-medal game. You didn't have a semifinals and a finals. It was actually a round robin, so you didn't know who the champion was going to be until all the games had been completed. At least this time around, you know, you knew who was going to win.
Yeah.
They went to the 3-on-3, and I think the 3-on-3 overtime is mainly because of contractual things. Like, you got to get off the air. Those athletes had to drive 2 hours back to a medal ceremony that was starting 6 hours after the game had started. So would I have liked to have seen a little bit of 5-on-5 before they went to maybe 4-on-4 and then maybe 3-on-3? Sure, but I understand the reason behind it. You had a good game, 1-1. You know, somebody had to come out on top, and at least it wasn't a shootout. You know, at least someone scored a goal to win it. Yeah, there's going to be guys that are crying, but these guys came with the ability to win. Now, I have to say this, Mike, and maybe I'll take some backlash on this. There was a team who was not there that back in the 80s was really, really tough.
Yeah.
And to win it without Russia there, CCCP, the Soviet Union, whatever you want to call it, I don't know if you put an asterisk there, but it definitely kind of holds back on the gold medal a little bit.
Yeah, it definitely takes a little something away. And not to make a basketball reference, but if you go back to 1984, when the Olympics were in Los Angeles and the U.S. won the gold medal in basketball, Russia boycotted that year because we had boycotted the their Olympics.
Yes.
And so it was one of those things where, yeah, was it an asterisk next to it, or it just felt a little different?
Yeah.
It's really a shame in this day and age that all athletes from every part of the globe, and call them the unified team or whatever it was a couple of years ago, that they couldn't have it. So it was definitely missing, because that, you know, Russia's tradition in hockey is unlike anybody else's.
Yeah, second to none, especially those guys are paid. And, you know, it was one of those things, though, where I kind of went back and watched a little bit of the old Miracle movie at this time. And then I tried to watch some of the new HBO one that they had out.
Yes.
The Netflix one, sorry. Mm-hmm. It just got me thinking a little bit. But I don't know, and I know this was probably, you know, it's 46 years now, and I've used the miracle to try and help some of my teams in a coaching era do better. But, like, I just feel like it was a Sunday morning, 8 o'clock game. My little guy at 7 years old was into it. But I think for the most part, if you went around and asked kids in a high school if they woke up to watch that game, I don't think there was any part of it.
Yeah.
And I just feel bad that, like, people really weren't on that and didn't understand the history of the 46 years that have gone since the team has won it. I felt a lot of excitement when they scored the game-winning goal.
I was actually in a restaurant I was in a diner having breakfast, and it was place was packed, and the game was on TV.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, due to circumstance that I couldn't control, the game ended while I was eating. Nobody made a peep.
Nobody.
Yeah, and it's a shame because
I mean there definitely were bars where people were there and partying and stuff.
But I think you make a good point. The general populace, it just didn't resonate.
Yeah, I don't know if like the younger generation is really into the Olympics.
Yeah.
And you know, but it was good for hockey. Let's just put it that way. And now you come back and maybe some of that buzz continues with the NHL and you know maybe you know leading towards the playoffs.
And slapping over here. Just quickly to the women's side,
yeah.
The rivalry between the U.S. and Canada in that game was even more intense, and because they had a lot of history going back, and you see now, you know, women's hockey's there's teams in New York, a team in Seattle the other night sold out 17,000, so good for them. They did unfortunately get a little less recognition.
Yeah, I think because theirs happened first.
Yeah,
you know, the men hadn't even gotten through their semifinal game yet. But yeah, that was good. It was a great win, and both of them, I think, happening with that extra time, and you know, it kind of helps. It helps to build the drama a little bit, and you know, I think nowadays people are going to be staring at the Islanders. The Rangers are falling off. The Islanders are stepping up, and this could be a chance for the Islanders to make a move. And you know, I think the spotlight is going to be on Matthew Schaefer for the Islanders.
I mean, when you're talking about an 18-year-old kid, he's already broken the record for goals by a defenseman.
He's got more goals than his age.
It's crazy. And I mean, when you listen to him talk, he's obviously an 18-year-old kid. He looks like he barely shaves.
Yeah.
But man, he is some kind of player. And Canada took a lot of heat for not picking him on their roster. You know, people were saying he could have been the difference because, especially in a wide open game, he's an offensive. He plays a great defense, but he can put the puck in the net. He can create. He's one of the most exciting athletes, I think, here in the New York area that we've had in quite some time.
Yep, and some former Islanders got a spot to be able to play. You had Brock Nelson in that game. You got to see Bo Horvat play for Canada. You know, they got a chance to show their spotlight. And, you know, I thought that was a good thing as well. But, you know, it should be interesting as the season, starts to come down at the end of March, where the Islanders fit and if they're able to make a run in the playoffs.
Yeah, because there was a little bit, you know, they were playing well before the break, and then there was a little bit of a worry maybe there'd be a letdown. You know, they came out, been playing pretty well. Last time I checked, they were
tied up.
They're tied up tonight with Florida. So it really is, you know, it's kind of a wide open scenario for them. As you mentioned, the Rangers, they've packed it in. Mm-hmm. They're building for the future, which, to the contrary, they say that they're not, but, you know, they're just, I never thought I would say this in my life, but I feel bad for Ranger fans because
it's tough.
There's just nothing to watch. There's no juice in the arena,
no.
And they have kind of a big rebuild ahead of them.
Yeah,
but they're exciting. The other team in the arena, the New York Knicks. We can get back to basketball real quickly before we. I want to end with baseball because it's with the weather, you know, starting to turn here. Hopefully, Knicks little up and down. Trade deadline came and passed. There was, you know, all sorts of rumors that Carl Anthony Towns is not happy. He's not being used the right way. He and Mike Brown haven't connected, all sorts of stuff. You know, what do you see, Cap? Do you see them going as far as they did last year and maybe getting to the final, or is this
I think that's too tricky. I think that's the goal when you bring in Mike Brown is to go further than you were last year because, you know, Tibbs was able to take them so far and then, you know, they stopped in the same spot that they always been stopping. But, you know, running into a brick wall with the Pistons, I think, is going to be their downfall. Yeah. I mean, it showed when they played them that Cade Cunningham is, you know, probably the best player in the Eastern Conference. And, you know, he's going to take that team to new levels. They've only lost 14 games this year. And surprisingly to me, the Celtics are really strong without Tatum. You know, they've won 66% of their games. And I would have told you, Mike, they're going to be a 500 team.
I think Joe Mazzulla has to be coach of the year by far.
Yeah,
to
Brad
have that,
Stevens.
To have that team where they're at. You make a good point. You know, I think with the Knicks, my feeling is, you know, obviously with bringing in Mike Brown, as you said, it was to utilize the bench a little bit more, maybe take some minutes away, you know, little longer rotation. When you get to the playoffs, that rotation is going to get, you know.
Yeah, they made some trades, brought in Alvarado and, you know, tried to give themselves more in the backcourt. They're going to be without Deuce, for a little while. I don't know.
Does it lead to fresh legs in the playoffs?
You can't tell now.
I really think that
you know, it's going to come down to, do they have enough in a seven-game series? Do they stay healthy? Because Brunson can be that man.
Yes.
Are the other guys like Bridges and Hart going to stay healthy enough to help? You know, Karl Anthony Towns has to step up and be bigger against some of the other big, big guys. But I just feel like the immovable force is the Detroit Pistons this year.
Yeah, they're just too solid, I think, to go from it, – there's really a great chance to have two teams in the finals, to have Detroit and have San Antonio that weren't even in the playoffs last year.
I just think the Spurs don't have enough experience to get there, and I think the Thunder do.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying regular season. I'm talking,
sure,
you know, postseason.
It would be something, yeah. I think the Spurs are just a little bit away. Props to Victor Wembanyama, who is playing – he's playing every single game, back-to-backs.
Yep.
I mean, I was watching the other night when they played the Nets, only because I was curious to see if he was going to play back-to-back. And he did, and he's one of the few young stars. As long as he's healthy, he's out there. And even if he's a little iffy, he's not taking nights off for anything.
Yeah.
And I give him credit because he actually was kind of instrumental in getting some juice back into the All-Star game. And you got to give him credit.
WGBB Sports Talk New York, 516-623-1240. If you want to call in, we'll take your call tonight. We've got a couple of minutes left. Mike and Chris here, we are talking sports. We haven't done this in a little while. We've always seemed to be battling guests minute by minute.
Guest-centric, yes. Yeah. Well, you know what? One of our last guests, Brad Ausmus, 2 weeks ago, coaching in the WBC for Team Israel, so that's going to lead us a little bit into baseball. On a nice but cold day today, I'm watching the Mets from Port St. Lucie. This to me is always, it's such a great thing. It's beautiful down there. There's, you know, short sleeve shirt, the breeze. But they made a good point. You were seeing a lot of guys getting time because now a lot of the stars are already with the WBC teams getting ready. There's just something about spring training when, you know, a guy wearing number 97 is out there, and if you're a fan of the team, but it really got me going for baseball today.
Yeah, you see some of those guys, and you hope that maybe some of them stick. And, you know, Carson Bench playing the outfield, former pitcher, catches a fly ball, throws it to home plate. The guy at third base decides to stay. You know, it's just one of those things where the Mets haven't had one of those in a while, and maybe they get themselves a guy who's got a BB out there, and, you know, guys are afraid to run on him. And, you know, we'll see what the Mets decide to do.
I was going to say, do you see him making the opening day roster?
I think there's just too many other pieces for them to bring him up now, unless he starts to just do everything in the next few games. But, you know, they got guys like MJ Melendez and Tyrone Taylor, and, you know, they still have Soto. They went out and got themselves a lot more pieces that I think you're able to hold him back. Same situation with Lindor being hurt. They went out and got themselves a lot more pieces, guys you've probably never heard of. But they could fill in for him that I think Ronnie Mauricio probably won't start the season because he has one more option left.
Right.
They'll send him back down. But I think if it's going to be a 7 to 12 day window, that Ronnie Mauricio is your best option at shortstop for that. The other thing is maybe Mauricio makes the team as the DH, and I know that sounds strange, but he's not great at defense, but his bat is very good.
Yeah.
And I think he's has a chance of swinging a bat. Maybe give him some options, but the Mets are going to be a new team. Is that new team enough to make the playoffs? I don't know, but I think it's going to be a new look, and there's going to be a lot of questions, Mike, about the clubhouse and whether or not this is a different team to be able to withstand some bad times.
Yeah, because you couldn't have made more changes than they did.
Oh, yeah.
There was a
the article with Nimmo.
Yeah, with
Nimmo. Spoke for an hour.
Which I
get it.
Yeah.
You know, but that's somebody trying to get that interview.
Right.
And he spoke about why me, you know, but it was why everybody. They got rid of everybody.
Yeah,
and he had 4 years left on his deal. We brought in Marcus Semien, only has 3 years left on his deal. They were trying to clean house.
Yeah, there was really little to no effort made truly to bring Pete Alonso back. So they go out, they sign Bo Bichette, who I love him as a player.
Okay.
But here's my question. So, you know, Bo Bichette is a top-notch second baseman. They bring him in, put him in third. You hear all different things about how difficult third base is. It's not difficult. What do you think? Is it, I mean, I'm no expert in baseball. I played infield. You know, for me, as a little league, you know, junior high, I played second, third, short. You know, when you're talking about the major leagues, it's very different, obviously. But I don't know. I'm not so worried about his glove and his arm.
I'm not sure how much I am worried. I think it's more of the sharp ball hit down the line than the regular ground ball moving left to right. I think he'll get used to that. You know, I'm not a big fan of moving Brett Beatty to the outfield and thinking that he can get a fly ball.
Yeah.
The infield is tough. I mean, you got to go over bunt situations, cutoff situations, relays, who's going out. Like,
oh, yeah.
All of that stuff can be new for a guy that's normally used to playing second base on a bunt. Maybe he's covering first. Now on a bunt, it's do I go get the bunt and throw to first, or do I retreat back to third base and try and get the tag? You know, there can be a lot more with that. So I think moving guys is something they didn't want to do mid-season. So Bo Bichette, third base. Juan Soto, left field. You know, I think they're trying to set people in positions. And, hey, Lindor's going to be out for a little while. We'll find a guy to do 10 days there.
Right.
And, you know, we'll plug somebody in instead of moving people around.
What about Mark Vientos?
Oh, boy. I don't know. There's not going to be a spot for both him and Jared Young and Brett Beatty and this guy. And, like, you can't have the same person who just happens to be a righty. Now,
right.
How many lefty pitchers are there out there for Mark Vientos to get at bats? He's going to play first base how many times?
Yeah, that's a great question.
I mean, if you're going to put Polanco at DH, you might get opening day, he's not starting.
No.
I'll tell you this much. You know why? It's Paul Skeens. It's Paul Skeens.
Yes.
Who are you putting up there? You're not putting up righties. You're putting up lefties who have experience,
right.
And that's it. So, like, how often are we really going to get Mark Vientos into a game? That's a problem, and I just don't see this roster going forward with all three of those guys, Young and Vientos and Brett Beatty. I just think at some point somebody's going to be let go.
Yeah, and Vientos – what is his trade value? You know, 2 years ago he was a hot commodity.
Yeah.
He kind of came out last year a little flat. Seemed like he felt like he had the position won, and
the
he
sophomore slump.
Yeah, and he I don't know. It just didn't show a lot of juice to him. I don't know.
I think the Mets, it's going to be their hitting this year that's going to need to step up, because Mike, their pitching is going to be really good.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Last thing I just want to finish with,
go ahead.
And if you're a high school basketball fan, player, coach, whatever, here on Long Island, just, you know, it was an interesting thing that took place the other day. Late in the game, team here on Long Island, Malvern, made a shot, and this is not to get on the Malvern fans or get on their players. My point is this. So Malvern takes the lead with points.
Less than a second.
With less than a second, and their players run on the court. Some fans run on the court. Technical foul.
In boys basketball, you have to call timeout in order to stop the clock in the last minute.
Right.
Coach came out to call timeout. Eventually was granted in some way, shape, or form that timeout.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
So for me in girls basketball, under the minute, clock automatically stops.
Correct.
Something I don't have to worry about. But this I'm just going to get on my soapbox for 30 seconds here. Fans, please stay off the court. Please. You get excited. I know. You know, you see things between, and there was no fights, thank goodness, but just every time you turn around now, you see a fight in the stands, people running on the court. Even in college, it's just ridiculous. Please stay off the court. As a coach, it's our job to teach our players to stay back. Kids get excited, whatever else, you know. But I think the fans running on the court really sealed their fate, and it's such a shame that happened. But just please let the kids play.
Yes.
And just,
from a supervisor standpoint,
yeah,
it's the last thing we want to see is people on the court. I had to break up something last year. It was not fun, not good. Mike, in 2 weeks, we're going to have Dave Sims, who is the Yankees play-by-play broadcaster, and we have March Madness. It's going to be a great night.
It's going to be unbelievable, and maybe we'll get to 2 hours.
Sunday.
Maybe we'll do a 2-hour special. We did last year, and it was something else. Thanks to Ted Valentine again, just a great guy, great resource. Cap, great show as always. We'll see you in a couple weeks. Brian Graves behind the glass, thank you. And stay warm, everybody, and think baseball.
Happy March.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
This is WGBB AM 1240 and W240 DFFM 95.9 Freeport, New York.